This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. It is a Friday. I saw sun today, and it's Week in Review. Not a bad start to the weekend, but a tough week on the COVID front. With cases climbing, the Delta variant spreading, and widely varying approaches on how to respond, Governor Baker not changing course on the reopening or schools.
We don't have plans to change our current policies with respect to school in the fall. And I think what's got to be the rule of thumb here is that people make decisions based on the current state of play. And we're in a very different place than most other parts of the country.
Acting Boston Mayor Kim Janey not quite on the same page.
There are a number of children who still are not eligible for the vaccine. And so children are currently wearing masks as they are in summer school. And in this fall, they will be wearing masks still.
And in Cambridge, Nantucket, Provincetown, mask advisories are back. Only three votes in the Massachusetts House against sports betting. Here's Representative Dan Cahill of Lynn.
They've been going to Seabrook. They've been going to out of state to make their bets. Folks, it's happening. It's going to continue to happen. But now in Massachusetts, we're able to recapture those revenues that are going out of state.
And as state GOP Vice Chairman Tom Mountain resigns over controversial social media posts, the party sinks deeper into scandal.
Don't be the creepy guy on Facebook. You are the vice chairman of this party. It is, you know, uncalled for, absolutely uncalled for.
Aidan Kearney, the man behind Turtle Boy, which first exposed the posts. But we are going to start with where we are and where we are headed in the pandemic. Call us and join the conversation. Folks, is it time to mask indoors again or take additional steps to encourage vaccination? And if so, what are those additional steps? What do you want to see? And how do you feel about vaccine mandates? Also, does the Delta variant concern you? Or have you had enough of the hair on fire over all of it? Call us with your thoughts. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Our panelists this week, Tito Jackson, former Boston City Councilor and now CEO of Verdant Medical, a cannabis company, and Jennifer Nasur, former chair of the Massachusetts Republican Party and founder and president of the Pocketbook Project, which supports center-right women for elected office. Tito, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
Jennifer, welcome back to you as well.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be on with you and Tito. Nice to talk with you, Tito.
Yes, I look much better on radio.
You always look good in person. Come on.
All right, well, let's get into it. And Tito, I am going to turn to you. Listen, here's what I want to ask you. I've been thinking about you because you've had COVID, and this is a tough moment. And I want to ask you, what's your sort of dominant sentiment right now? Is it anger, fatigue, worry? What are you thinking?
I worry. I worry most for friends and family members who don't want to get the vaccine. I've been reading a lot. I was reading about a gentleman in his 30s. I was reading about him this week, and he had to get a double lung transplant, and he refused to get the vaccine. And so, my message to those that are out there, and I know parts of Boston, I know my friends in Mattapan have some of the lowest vaccination rates, is I had it, it's real, and it can do real long-term damage. And that's the one piece that people forget when it comes to COVID. It's not necessarily the acute aspect of COVID that is really going to stick with you. There are many long haulers out there whose bodies have been irreparably harmed. So please, please be vigilant. And the new strains that weren't out when I got it, that weren't as transmissible when I got it, are out there. I think Mayor Janey is right to have the Boston Public Schools equipped with masks for all young people and all adults, knowing that young people have not had the opportunity, many of them, to receive the vaccination.
Let's pick up on that. And Jennifer, I'm going to turn to you, but I want to play some sound here. This is Dr. Ashish Jha. He's Dean of the Brown School of Public Health. He's been here on Radio Boston a number of times. This time he's on ABC's Good Morning America. Here it is.
This is the most contagious version of the virus we have seen throughout the whole pandemic. It's really very, very contagious. And there's so much more virus around. People who are infected have such high viral loads that even short periods of time, 5 minutes, 7 minutes, you don't even have to be within 6 feet. For people who are unvaccinated, they are getting infected with much, much shorter exposure.
Jennifer, I mean, oh my God, just listening to that. And we are talking about a viral load that's roughly 1,000 times higher than sort of the original strain of COVID. Delta could be up to twice as transmissible. It wasn't that long ago that the CDC head, Rochelle Walensky, was talking about this being a pandemic of the unvaccinated. But those data, that data is scary. What do you think?
Well, I agree with Dr. Walensky. I mean, I think if you look, listen, you know, what's amazing to me is last year, all we talked about was follow the science. Now this year, suddenly science means nothing and it's all just hearsay. And so I think we need to follow the science. The science says if you are vaccinated, 99% chance you are not going to get COVID. And if we remember what COVID was all about and what the biggest fear and concern was people dying, and death is a concern. So we don't stop people from getting the flu. You can still get the flu with a flu shot, but you're not going to die. You can still get chicken pox. You can still get measles, mumps. People still have all of those things. But the whole thing that we need to prevent is death. So I agree 1,000% with Tito. It is the messaging. It is getting out into communities and telling people this is safe and it's effective. Now, you know, one of the biggest problems that you run into is it's still not completely approved by the federal government. It's still emergency. So until the federal government can push this through and make sure that it is actually fully approved, I do think that there's still a messaging component. But at the end of the day, it works. I'm fully vaccinated. My kids are fully vaccinated. My kids that are able to get vaccinated are vaccinated. And we can live our lives, right? And yep, without fear of death. And I think that's the important thing is I'm fine having a cold. I'm fine being in bed for a day or two. I don't want to die.
Yeah. Well, that is good.
Right? I mean, I think that's how we all feel. We just don't want to die.
That's
a double
right.
lung transplant sounds terrible. I mean, that's no way to live. And so it's a messaging component of, look, you might have all these misconceived notions. Stop reading Facebook. Stop reading Twitter, right? Like, stop getting your information online from
yes.
people that don't have medical degrees and listen to the experts. And the experts say it's safe and effective. Let's go with that.
And let's pick up a call on this 800-423-8255. We've got Marie on the line in Bolton. Marie, go ahead.
Hi, yes. Good afternoon. My name's Marie. I'm a teacher at Algonquin Regional High School. That's Northborough, Southborough. And having gone through almost the entire year until early March without a vaccine, you know, all of us, despite the extraordinary efforts by our, you know, the administration, it was terrorizing. We were afraid. I had the, I shouldn't call it an opportunity to quarantine for 2 weeks, but, you know, all of that terror that we endured, and my older sister is an ICU nurse at Mass General, and hearing the stories coming from there, and they sounded like the, you know, the really tragic stories about people dying, you know, of COVID, and then to turn around and see this reluctance to getting vaccinations and feeling like just so many people in this country don't.
Thanks,
get.
Marie. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Thank you, Marie.
It.
Yeah. And so I hear that frustration, especially as somebody who's saying, hey, I was terrified until I could get a vaccine. I think this picks up on some of your point, Jennifer. Tito, I want to play some sound from Governor Baker down on the Cape yesterday.
The fact that there are cases should not be surprising. There's a big difference between cases when you have no one vaccinated and cases when you have 4.3 million people vaccinated. The big question is, what do those cases mean with respect to hospitalizations and people getting really sick? I would argue that vaccines have proved their mettle.
And Tito, I want to point out that the death rate of COVID among the vaccinated in Massachusetts as of July 17th was 0.0018%. Jennifer says we've got messaging needs and messaging problems here, right? No vapors, please. Oh. And we got to get the word out to people to get vaccinated. How do we strike that balance? And have we done a poor job of striking it lately?
Well, I think we have to be aggressive. And I know that there are beginning to be restaurants and bars in the city of Boston that are actually having either a mask mandate, or they actually make individuals show their vaccination cards if they're going to take their mask off. So I think there is a vigilance component here, and I think the governor is speaking the truth in, one, looking at the regional nature of this. We know that there's been a flare-up in the P-Town area, and we also know that people in the state of Massachusetts travel, right? It's not a large state, so we have to really look at the regional components. But then we actually have to really dig into the pockets, neighborhoods, and communities, and get really granular in terms of making sure that we have people who are trusted commodities in those communities, who are speaking to folks to kind of push through many of these issues. I know in my community, you know, Black folk were disproportionately affected, in particular with their death rates in terms of getting COVID. But the flip side of it is it has been an issue in the past of mistrust when it comes to the medical establishment, Tuskegee Syphilis Experiment and other things that have come up in the past. So having people who folks trust to actually connect with individuals in the community is absolutely critical, and there needs to be the funding in order to do that. And I think this is a really critical and pivotal time to make sure that we're doing the right thing, because we know, as Marie brought up, there is not only a physical health component, but there is a mental health component that goes along with thinking. You know, now when you get the sniffles, you know, I get nervous when I get the sniffles.
Now there's trauma.
So that's another component around the trauma and the mental health components of us being. And I actually had to quarantine for a month. And I was a little, and if you can believe that, I actually wasn't the best around people after that. So I think there's a lot that we have to do. I guess the last piece is, we are all connected, Tiziana and Jennifer. We are all connected, and what each of us do matters, because we can either be part of a solution or part of the problem.
So I want to pick up on a couple of things there. You know, we spoke with Congressman Jake Auchincloss on Radio Boston earlier this week, and he sounded a note of impatience that I hear creeping into the public sphere more. Here he is.
I'm feeling very frustrated, to be to be candid with you, because the vaccines are in abundance now in this country. And at a time when other countries throughout the world are struggling to get enough supply, we're having to give pickup trucks to people to convince them to get a shot that is truly a miracle of science.
So then we've got private sector organizations beginning to step in and say, we are going to mandate this. Boston University, which holds the license for WBUR, although it doesn't affect us in our editorial decision making, decided this week to require faculty and staff to get vaccinated. It had already required students. Dr. David Hamer from BU, Boston Medical Center, is part of the decision making body at BU. Here he is on Ask the Doctors earlier this week.
I'm increasingly concerned. Delta is much more contagious, and increasingly I'm hearing about Delta leading to a much higher viral load in the sort of nasopharynx, and that could facilitate transmission and lead to vaccine breakthroughs.
So you've got the private sector starting to say, we're concerned, do it. You've got a changing tone from public leaders saying, this is getting really frustrating. We've given you the opportunity. This is life-saving. Do it. It makes me think, Jennifer, I do not mean to make light of this situation at all, but there's that quote from Patrick Swayze in Roadhouse. It's time to be nice and to be nice and to be nice until it's time not to be nice. Are we seeing a shift in leadership tone and a shift in where the onus is to get people vaccinated?
So, here it's a really interesting question, right? Because from a legal standpoint, I think it's going to become, at some point, someone is going to challenge this in the courts. Because again, this isn't it's still an emergency use vaccine. And I think that some private institutions are going to find themselves in court battles by people who have religious or health reasons why they don't want to get the vaccine. Now, I'm not, again, like I told you, I'm vaccinated, and my two teenagers are also vaccinated. And I fully believe in this. But if you have some reason why you're not, and your institution is requiring it, and it takes you, if you're a professor, off the tenure track, because you're Zooming into classes and you're not showing up physically to work every day, or if you're in the administrative office, or if you're a student and your grade suffers, it is going to be a legal challenge. And so, you know, again, I go back to the messaging. When our leaders are not leading, when our leaders have conflicting messages, when it's saying, if you're vaccinated, then you go inside, you still have to wear a mask. Why get vaccinated? Because a lot of people want to go back and live their lives. So I think, you know, some of it has to go to a personal responsibility. If I'm not a smoker, I'm just going to use this. If I decided that I wanted to smoke 5 packs of cigarettes a day and I got cancer, that's on me. If I want to text and drive, I mean, are we going to take drivers away? Or are we going to take cell phones away? Because you see people texting and driving, and for some reason, that's not an issue. I see people smoking weed and driving. For some reason, that's not an issue.
Oh, so, but there know, are
at some
laws.
Point, there has to be some personal responsibility in this too, in that us people who are vaccinated shouldn't have to suffer because other people are not getting the message.
So I do not want to undermine your point. I hear your point. I do want to note there are laws about the things that you're talking about, but I know you're talking about social
people
norms.
Still do it
right,
anyway.
Right. Tito, right. Let me come back to you. And actually, I want to put the number out just one more time on this. Do you believe in vaccine mandates, whether it's by employers or other entities? 800-423-8255. I'd take a call on that. Tito, back to you.
Yeah, I think I actually support the organizations that are making sure that everyone's safe, because the one other component here is that you can't tell who's vaccinated, right? So there's not, other than having a card, you can't look at someone and tell whether or not they're vaccinated. And we are living in times, as Jennifer noted, where people want to get back to regular life. And the only way that we're actually going to be able to get there is that all of us are going to have to get to a point where folks are vaccinated. So I do believe that in particular private organizations have the right to step forward and want to protect them, but also their employees. And if you've talked about, and you heard Marie speak about it earlier, let's also think about, you know, we talked about how great the healthcare professionals and the first responders and the those essential employees were. Well, we disrespect all of their work by not accommodating a vaccine and taking care of one another, because these individuals sadly had to see people pass with their family on an iPad. Mm. And that's the other component that a lot of folks, you know, haven't thought about. I've had friends and family, friends and family members who've passed. And remember, it's not like a normal passing. You're not at the bedside. Many of these folks actually had to pass on their own, and that's not at all what we want to see, and that's that remains traumatizing to the friends and family members of that person.
I want to pick up a call here. We've got Kate on the line in Newton. Kate, go ahead.
Hi, I just wanted to talk about breakthrough cases, because 2 weeks ago I went to a bar with 7 friends, and 4 of us ended up testing positive for COVID after that.
Wow.
And we're all vaccinated.
How long ago were you vaccinated, Kate, just so I know?
Vaccinated in April.
Okay. All right. Thanks. And we are hearing these stories, and we are trying to always be responsible about the anecdotal stories we're hearing versus the research data that we know. You know, we've seen numbers earlier this week out of the city of Cambridge showing that of their 80-something new cases this week, 42% of those cases were in people who were vaccinated. That is not the same as a vaccine breakthrough rate, because the denominator is different. But Jennifer, does that weaken the argument with those who have not been vaccinated yet when they hear, well, even if I know people who did get vaccinated and they're still getting COVID? I worry about that.
No, because, I mean, it goes back, you know, Tito's been saying it and I've been saying it. It goes back to the death. It goes back to hospitalizations. The governor said it, yeah. Right? You cannot prevent people. If you get the flu shot, anyone listening, if you've gotten the flu shot, how many of you have actually gotten the flu even though you have a flu shot? but your flu might be 24 hours or 48 hours versus 2 weeks. And that is the same thing with COVID. We are never going to get to zero cases. What we want are zero deaths. We're never going to get to zero cases. So if you look at this like getting the flu shot, it's the same thing. You just want to prevent people from getting very sick, landing in the hospital, and dying. And so when we have over 4 million people and 70% of the population, that was exactly where we were trying to get to when this mess first started. So we don't want people to die. And, you know, I'll say, like, the poo-poo on Donald Trump and poo-poo on Kamala Harris, because, you know, this was Trump's big mission to get this vaccine going. But because of his fight with Fauci, he decided not to publicize him getting the shot in public. And then you had Kamala Harris, who, as Vice President of the United States, said, I'm never going to get that shot because it's from Donald Trump. So what you have are people on both sides who stick their heels in the ground because the leaders that they look up to didn't do their job. And so for the rest of us who said, we're going to go out, we're still going to get this vaccine, we want to live our lives. Again, the fact of the matter is we don't want to be in bed for 2 weeks. We don't want to be hospitalized. We don't want to die.
All right. So just when Kamala Harris said that, it was actually during the campaign before she was vice president and the vaccines weren't available yet. That's a fact checking thing. Again, I understand your point. And she is vaccinated.
Yeah, she got and she got it from a Massachusetts company, Moderna, and she got it on December 28th.
And the president of former president of the United States also got vaccinated, to your point, Jennifer. Okay, Tito, just 30 seconds here. Last point to you as well, and then we'll go to break.
Listen, we are all interconnected. Each of us actually matter when it comes to this, and we each have a personal responsibility to each other, our friends and our family and loved ones, to be safe, to get vaccinated, and to ensure we cut the spread of COVID-19. I had it. It's real. It is absolutely not a myth. And it is absolutely critical that we actually turn, as my former boss would say, turn to each other in these difficult economic times. Well, it's not economic, actually difficult healthcare times, not on each other. Right. We have an opportunity to do that.
Still with us, Jennifer Nasur, former chairwoman of the Massachusetts Republican Party, and Tito Jackson, former Boston City Councilor, and you. And we're going to take your calls now. We're going to talk now about the Massachusetts GOP. Join us in this conversation. Here's what I really want to ask you out there. Does this matter to you? A state party tearing itself apart while registration hovers around 10% of the Massachusetts population. Does party vitality matter, or is it just about candidates in the race? Are you paying attention to this? If so, why? And if not, why are you tuning it out? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation. Now, as we set this up, I want to start by saying that we're going to talk about a story here, and there is a lot that we still don't know and that is still in dispute. What we do know is that the former vice president of the state GOP committee, Tom Mountain, resigned after a provocative website called Turtle Boy Daily News published a story with screenshots of comments to young women on social media that were inappropriate and deeply uncomfortable and attributed to Tom Mountain. Mountain claims he was set up and has obtained counsel, resigned. Jennifer Nasur, your reaction.
Yeah, there's so much here. So let's start with how this originated. This originated because Tom Mountain went after Chairman Jim Lyons, and all of a sudden Tom Mountain finds himself in a bad situation. Whether he was set up or not, you know, is to play out. His comments are abhorrent, and I'm glad that he resigned. However, there's a bigger situation here, which is the mess that the Mass GOP is in currently. And you have a chairman who is not willing to be flexible. He does not want a big tent. He is being supportive of certain candidates. He is not supportive of our current elected officials, and he needs to also resign. And so I think that the issues are so multifaceted here that we could not cover it in one show, let alone a week or a month.
Yeah. Okay. So I want to correct myself. I said vice president of the state committee. It's vice chair of the state committee. And I'm going to play two pieces of sound, Tito, here from Sean Dooley, a state representative who was speaking with WBUR's Anthony Brooks. Here he is talking about whether or not Mountain may have experienced a setup.
You know, they catfished him. They tried to destroy this man, his family, his marriage. But to what point? This purity test that if you're not with us 100%, you're our enemy is incredibly destructive. And I think it's immoral.
Okay, then he goes on to talk about the state of the party.
I think the state party is just simply a laughingstock. We're doubling down on losing.
So I do want to note that Sean Dooley did run against the current chair of the state Republican Party, Jim Lyons, and lost the chairmanship by 3 votes in the most recent election. Tito Jackson, Jennifer had a lot of sharp words for us and there's about this, and I'm going to go back to her in a minute. But I want to ask you, the Democratic Party, does it sit back and say, hey, let's watch this party implode? Or is there something bad for democracy in a two-party system when one party is hurting like this, and should it matter to everyone?
I will quote one of the philosophers that I like to follow in the old 21st century philosopher, KRS-One. He said, self-destruction, you're headed for self-destruction. And that's exactly what's happening with the party. It is bad as a whole when elected officials and even in party officials, one, are doing essentially creepy stuff. That's just not good ever. But I think it all feeds into cynicism as a whole. Negative politics is one of the things that actually drives down votes. And we actually live in a state of Massachusetts that there are more people who are unenrolled or independent than in either Jennifer or I's party. And things like this leave a really bad taste in people's mouth when we talk about people engaging, and particularly bringing people who have not felt that they could get into the process, or those individuals who are young folks being in the process. All of this is negative, net negative for everyone. And I think there's a lot going on in the party. Jennifer, I'm sorry, I can't help you guys on this one. Apologize. I know I do a whole lot, but can't help you on this one. But there's a lot that the party has to get together. And the biggest issue with the Mass GOP in the state of Massachusetts is they're not paying attention to the people of the state of Massachusetts. They're paying attention to the internal bickering. Folks still have issues around jobs. Businesses are still having issues recovering. We still have these issues around COVID-19. The people and the problems that they have should be front of mind rather than the internal bickering back and forth.
I want to grab a call here, 1-800-423-8255, to join the conversation. We've got Sam on the line in Cambridge. Sam, go ahead.
Hi, thank you. Yeah, I mean, I think it's just not all that interesting what's the drama going on in the Republican Party, because it's just really yet one more symptom of this deep...
Oops, we lost you there, Sam. If we get you back, we'll let you know. Sorry that we missed you there. But so, Jennifer, I'm going to come back to you on a couple of things. Okay, so look, you talked about the battle between Mountain and Chair Jim Lyons. We know that Jim Lyons refused to condemn deeply homophobic emails by State Committee member Deborah Martell toward a gay Republican candidate for Congress. This was earlier this year. 29 of the 30 Massachusetts House Republicans in the State House, Governor Baker and Lieutenant Governor Polito, called on him to resign. Then there was a letter from some former state party chairs. You signed that letter. Jim Lyons this week, talking to Anthony Brooks, wouldn't comment on the Tom Mountain situation, but said this about building the party up from a grassroots level.
And particularly in conservative Republican-leaning districts where we haven't been successful over the last 20 or 30 years, and clearly the elites in the party don't view it the same way.
Which made me want to ask you, Jennifer, what is the job of a state party chair?
So I'm going to address something he said. Now, number one, Sam is totally correct, and so is Tito. So let me just go back one second.
Go.
To have democracy, you need a thriving two-party system, which clearly Jim Lyons is not in favor of, because all he's in favor of is making the Republican Party as right could be, which is exactly what Tito said, which is not listening to the voters in Massachusetts. What our elected officials who are elected, the good men and women elected to office in Massachusetts that have an R next to their name, what they are doing is actually listening to their constituency, listening to the voters. So let's put that out there. Now, as far as what Jim Lyons said, I will tell you, he is full of baloney, because, and that's my kind word for radio. I was the last chair that there were 17 Republicans elected while I was chair, because I actually did have a grassroots organization where we went out, we supported candidates, we raised the money, we took care of them. We also elected Scott Brown to the U.S. Senate. So I don't know what Jim Lyons is smoking. Maybe Tito, you can help me out here. And whatever you're giving him, make sure it stops. Because he is completely delusional. So our party registration has gone down in the past 10 years. And so it is, I will tell you that the other party chairs who signed that letter with me, all of them felt exactly the same way, that our party, the party leaders, the job of a party chair is to build the party, to have a big tent. And actually, it doesn't matter what your party registration is, because like Tito pointed out, there are more unenrolled in Massachusetts than there are people combined in the Republican and the Democrat parties in Massachusetts. So instead, the important thing is your messaging, how you communicate with people, and making sure that the face of the party is someone that is relatable to the voters. And at the current time, that is not Jim Lyons.
Okay, so I'm going to pick up there. Two things. One, just to note, we have invited Jim Lyons to come here on Radio Boston a number of times. We'll continue to do so. And I'm doing it right now. We would love to have the chair of the State Republican Committee come on to Radio Boston and talk these things through with us. So now we talk about candidates who are trying to serve the people, which both of you have brought up. And this raises an interesting point, too. We do not know if Governor Charlie Baker, who is clearly at odds with the state party leadership right now, is going to run again for governor. We do know that former state representative and former Senate candidate Jeff Deal has decided to run for governor. Formerly a strong Donald Trump supporter, chaired the Massachusetts portion of the campaign in 2016, seems to have backed away from that to some extent now. Maybe is challenging primarying Charlie Baker, maybe not. Depends on what Charlie Baker's going to do. But I wonder, will this internecine battle about the nature and the personality of the Republican Party play out in races like a governor's race? Or are we at a point where, with so many people independent and voting independently, candidates can kind of rise above this stuff, Tito?
I don't necessarily think, you know, in Jeff's, and I know Jeff, I don't think that you can run the Trump campaign in the state of Massachusetts and just back up off of it and just turn the page. The real issues that are facing the people, and I think we all need to remember January 6th was January 6th of 2021. It wasn't a long time ago. That actually happened, and those things are real. And then the real issues that, again, people in the state of Massachusetts are facing. And I think individuals who are taking this really hard right tact, I think they're going to have a really difficult time in the state of Massachusetts that is in recovery, but absolutely needs help. And as I noted before, folks who are willing to take just simply partisan stances rather than deal with and meet people where they are, meeting them halfway to help all of us do better, help these schools open, help businesses get what they need, and folks who are many people still unemployed get back to work. Those are the real issues that people have to address. And if you're not addressing them, in 2021, you're absolutely not relevant and you will not win.
1-800-423-8255. In a minute, we're going to go on to sports betting, and I'm going to ask you, listeners, are you in favor of it? The Massachusetts State House supporting it yesterday. I'm going to give the last word here to a caller. We've got Richard on the line in Natick. Richard, go ahead.
Hi, I'm a card-carrying Democrat, and it's my opinion that if we don't have at least two viable parties, we can't have conversations about what society should do. And with a Republican Party in this kind of disarray, we can't have conversations, and we're not necessarily doing the right things we should be doing.
I appreciate that call, Richard, and I'm going to let that sort of be the drop the mic moment on that last conversation. Tito, Jennifer, I'm going to turn us now to sports betting. Early days on the question, the Massachusetts House passed it yesterday. There's some substantive differences between the proposals in the House and the Senate won't take it up for a few weeks. But I noticed that the vote was 156-3. If you had told me 10 years ago that we'd be here and with that kind of majority supporting sports betting legalization in the Commonwealth, I wouldn't have believed you. Tito Jackson, what's changed? Is it just the Supreme Court ruling a few years ago that the U.S. can no longer outlaw it, or is there something more going on here?
I think the Supreme Court ruling, also the acknowledgement that it has been happening, be it on the illicit side of things, but also that revenue has been lost. We have gone over the line now, and we have casino gambling. But the biggest issue I actually have with this bill is actually we can learn some things from the current industry that I'm in, the cannabis industry, which actually has a social equity program, has an economic empowerment program that looks out for small business as well as people of color. And I think the biggest miss here, when I hear them talking about tracks as well as casinos, when you say casinos, by the way, you mean two companies in the state of Massachusetts, which are huge, huge companies. What about rolling this out? And I know there's been some talk around this for mom and pop bodegas, bars, convenience stores that would have a shot rather than allowing the billionaire class of businesses in casinos as well as racetracks to be able to have all of the upside. So again, when you say casino, that's synonymous with just two large companies.
Go ahead, give your shout out.
I did want to give a shout out to my teacher, Barry Schumann. He's my English teacher from high school. He finished radiation treatment today, and I told him I was going to be using the word synonym on NPR, and he needs to change my grade.
Nice. I expect it to be an A. I got an A from Judge Nancy Gertner last time she was on the show, and now I'm giving you an A. Tito, I used to be a professor. I can do that. All right, so listen, to clarify what Tito said, a couple of key provisions. Only mobile apps and facilities that already do live betting, like the casinos and horse racing tracks, will have licenses to take bets. Jennifer, we talked to Victor Matheson here on the show earlier this week. He's a professor of economics and accounting at Holy Cross who studies sports betting, about the kinds of numbers we're talking about.
If we see something like the UK, where they have had widespread legalization of sports gambling for decades, they have over $1,000 of wagers being made a year for every adult in the country. Translate that to Massachusetts, and you're talking about $5 billion of wagers being made, and you'd be talking easily in the tens of millions of dollars of revenue.
So, Jennifer, I asked him, okay, but can you translate that to Massachusetts? And he basically said, yep. So, to Tito's point about making sure there's an equity component, about making sure that small businesses benefit from this as well, and recognizing that there's still strong pushback in the Commonwealth about the concerns and issues of risks with gambling addiction and people with low-margin households not being able to afford to lose the money, what are some important policy steps to take if this thing is coming?
So, I think it is going to be difficult because we now let the cat out of the bag, right? And so, you know, but that happened when casinos became legal. So we legalized casinos, and now there's legalized, you know, gambling, and Rhode Island, New Hampshire, and Connecticut have it. And so I think we have to now look at what our neighboring states are doing, because we don't want to lose that revenue source, because it's you know, very easy to get over the border into any of these states. And so if we make it too restrictive, then we are going to lose that revenue. And, you know, that sounds great, right? Who doesn't want extra revenue? Extra revenue means extra dollars for our schools and our kids and our communities. And that's all a good thing, especially after the year that we had.
So we know that the Senate won't take it up probably until the fall. When I spoke with WBUR's senior statehouse reporter Steve Brown earlier this week, he said, Tito, that the kinds of revenues we're talking about here on the debate and the House floor was around $60 million at least a year in tax revenues. A variety of places that's going, everything from city and aid to cities and towns to workforce training for low-income residents, money for nonprofits. How important, I'm going to flip this question around, how important is it that, if it is, for the state to pass this and get that money into our coffers?
Well, one of the things we also probably should agree upon is that this is essentially regressive taxation. People who disproportionately can't afford it participate, right? So let's also, this is not the tech industry, biotech and life sciences. Let's just be very clear on where these dollars are coming from. So, and as you noted before, there are many who have addiction issues and the like. I personally believe, and this is, Jennifer and I will probably disagree on this one. I personally believe that we should have had a higher, we should have kept our state income tax at a higher rate, and we would actually not have some of the systemic issues that we have relative to not being able to find the dollars to support schools, roads, rails, and bridges across the state. So I would have liked to have seen it more on a broad-based tax side. But if, as I noted, if we are going to do this, it is critical that we spread it out. And when we look at the double-fold bottom line, yeah, okay, cool. The State House got a lot of dough from the feds, but that money is going to run out. And how do we sustain things? It is critical that those dollars be invested in thoughtful ways that will allow us to sustain our schools, roads, rails, bridges, as well as infrastructure across the state. But I also do believe that there should be a chunk of this that goes to make sure that we're dealing with those individuals who have a problem with gambling.
Okay.
Because it's scary. Yeah.
I'm sorry. I got to wrap us. No, I'm so sorry. We are actually out of time. I actually have to wrap us here. So that was Tito Jackson, former Boston City Councilor, now CEO of Verdant Medical, and Jennifer Nasur, former chair of the Massachusetts Republican Party and founder and president of the Pocketbook Project. Thanks to both of you. That was fun. Glad to have you both. Okay, folks, we're going to go to a break. Yeah. And when we come back, we're going to go to Tokyo. You are listening to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Athletes from around the world will be entering their second day of competition for this year's Olympic Games. I know this is hard to get your head around, but the opening ceremony took place Friday night in Tokyo, which was this morning, our time. Thanks to the pandemic, this year's Games are far from run-of-the-mill. But the Boston Globe's Gary Washburn is there. We caught up with him in the middle of the opening ceremony this morning. You'll hear it in the background. And I asked him what it's like to experience this most unorthodox of Olympic openings.
I mean, it's a little surreal. I mean, they're going through all the glitz and the glamour, the introduction of the nations and the athletes and, you know, the elaborate show, but there's no fans. There's only media members here and Olympic officials, you know, so it's performing for basically for the television audience.
So tell us a little bit about the restrictions that are in place, Gary.
Basically, we have to test every day, a saliva test. We cannot take any public transportation. I'm talking about the media members. We're doing Zoom calls with the athletes. There'll be some in-person situations, but socially distanced. Everyone gets tested. We have to register our temperature every day. We cannot leave our hotels. Reporters cannot walk around the city.
It sounds really restrictive. Is it affecting the morale of the athletes?
I mean, I think that everyone knew what to expect when they got here. They're just going to try to make the best of the situation. For some people, it's their first Olympics, so they're excited just to be here. I mean, it's still the Olympics. There's still people from all over the world that are here to represent their country. So I think the athletes are looking at it like that, as opposed to, oh, this is terrible, or we can't do what we want.
Gary, who are some of the New England athletes and who are you watching from our sort of delegation, if you will?
Well, there's several, but the main one I'm watching is boxer Rashida Ellis from Lynn. She had a chance to win the gold medal. She has been a tremendous female boxer, and she's going to turn pro right after this Tokyo Games. There's like 35 athletes from New England. So, I mean, as you know, New England produces a lot of athletes in a lot of different sports, so there's a lot to watch here.
So I want to stay with athletes for a minute. So far, we know of nearly 100 who have tested positive for the coronavirus, which dashes their dreams to compete. We also know some have dropped out because of increased protocols. First, how many U.S. athletes are in the mix of having dropped out at this point? And second, does that mean there's going to sort of be an asterisk against gold medals won in this Olympics because the competitive pool might not be the same as it would be in a normal year?
This is not the Olympics that would have been normal if there was no COVID. I mean, there would be a lot more athletes here who would choose to participate. There's a lot who passed on participating and coming to Tokyo. But I don't think any time you compete and win a gold medal, there's an asterisk.
So, Gary, coronavirus is raging in Japan. I think it's fair to say that. They recently had a record high number of cases in a single day. Polls show that most of the Japanese public don't want the Olympics in Tokyo because of the pandemic. Is this happening in a hostile local environment, or is it just sort of separated and benign?
No, it's definitely not normal. You can hear the protesters outside the arena, since there's no fans here in the arena. You can hear the protesters, you know, marching outside it because they don't want the Olympics in Tokyo. But as we walked into the arena, there was a whole group, a whole hundreds of Japanese people waving at us. So it seems to be a little split. I mean, I think there's people that are very gracious. They haven't had the Olympics here in 57 years, 1964. So I think there's a population that's happy to have it here, and probably a younger population that doesn't want it here. So that was split, because I was a little surprised walking up to the arena for opening ceremonies, how many people were waving, taking pictures, were out and about, just wanting to be part of the atmosphere.
So, Gary, you're reporting, but of course, you also get to watch live, and not a lot of people get to do that this year. What are you personally most excited about watching and being present for?
It was a lot. You know, Simone Biles in gymnastics, Katie Ledecky in swimming. I'm always excited about the track and field. USA basketball will have a very tough road, men's and women's team, to winning the gold medal. And also sports that I don't get a chance to watch very often. I always like to go out and catch, you know, field hockey, or, you know, equestrian, something that we don't get generally see in the United States, or it's not very popular. So I just think this is a smorgasbord of sports. If you're a sports fan, the next 2 weeks will be wonderful. Even regardless of there not being fans in the arena, it's still the Olympics, and it still should be cherished.
All right, that's Gary Washburn. He's a reporter with the Boston Globe, joined us from Tokyo, where he's covering this year's Olympics. Gary, hey, thank you, and enjoy.
Thank you.
That is our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderick, Walter Wuthman, and Amanda Beland. We had help from Ali Audette. Marquise Neal is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Tisiana Deering. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. Join us again Monday for more Radio Boston.